It is Tuesday, July 7th. We are looking at a messy political collapse in Maine and the hard reality of AI infrastructure. Following up on yesterday, the volatility we keep tracking in tech and governance is only picking up speed. Here is what you need to know. The Democratic campaign in Maine is effectively over. A candidate is facing credible sexual assault allegations from a former partner. And the situation worsened when he lied to his own supporters about the existence of exculpatory evidence. National Democratic figures and activist groups have pulled their support, and the party is now scrambling to find a replacement before the July 13th ballot deadline. Here is the thing about this mess. Republicans are aware of the allegations, but they have purposely sat on opposition research to keep the candidate in the race until that July deadline passes. They are betting that if he drops out, the Democrats will be too disorganized to mount a coherent replacement effort. It is a cynical play, but it highlights a recurring failure in modern political organizations. They are consistently failing to vet their candidates before primary cycles end. They are leaving themselves open to these kinds of systemic collapses whenever a private history surfaces after a nomination is locked in. Voter support for the president has collapsed. Research tracking 36 voters since 2024 shows that even the most enthusiastic Trump supporters have soured. Through September of last year, the base was energized by border policy and executive actions. That support has evaporated. Voters across the spectrum now report feeling anxious and pessimistic. The drop in approval ratings correlates directly with a series of high-profile crises. Reports of potential changes to the East Wing, the ongoing regional tensions in the Middle East, and the public backlash against ICE have effectively rebranded the president. He is no longer seen as an economic manager, but as a source of instability. It turns out that even a highly motivated base has a limit. When the government looks distracted by personal projects or chaos, people notice the hit to their cost of living. Switching to the economy, we are in a period of structural rotation. High volatility is the new baseline, and the market is moving away from the concentration-led rallies we saw with the Magnificent Seven. Companies are now focused on operational efficiency, growing revenue without adding staff, and managing capital expenditure. There is a correction happening in high beta chip stocks right now. Capital expenditure to sales ratios are peaking, and valuations are being forced back toward their 200-day moving averages. This is not a crash, but it is a necessary adjustment. Because these tech sectors hold so much weight in the index, the S&P 500 is likely to struggle for the next 4 to 8 weeks until this rotation finishes. Fed Chair Kevin Warsh is also changing the rules of the game. He is moving away from prescriptive forward guidance. This gives him more political flexibility, but it leaves the market flying blind. Without a clear Federal Reserve reaction function, investors are responding to every single piece of data. That is why we are seeing so much volatility as we approach meeting dates. The administration's long-term economic thesis relies on an AI-driven productivity boom to grow out of national debt. If that happens, the economy has a buffer. If it fails, the reliance on high interest rates to anchor the long end of the yield curve becomes unsustainable. That would force a much more aggressive monetary response from the Fed. Keep an eye on the strait, too. Regional bottlenecks have permanently increased global shipping and insurance costs. This is not a temporary anomaly. It is the new price of doing business. This trend toward managed outcomes is showing up in our indices. The NASDAQ 100 is adding SpaceX under accelerated rules, skipping standard listing requirements. This is not passive investing anymore. It is a move to provide liquidity for insiders. $1.4 trillion in capital is tied to that index, so when index funds are forced to buy SpaceX, it creates artificial price pressure. It is essentially offloading risk from private insiders onto retail investors who think they are playing a safe, diversified game. The labor market is not doing much to help, either. growth is concentrated in narrow sectors like healthcare and social assistance. Prime-age labor force participation is down, and real wages are failing to keep pace with inflation. We are looking at a market that is structurally unable to deliver the wage growth necessary for an average household to feel stable. Meanwhile, the line between government and private influence continues to blur. The Trump administration reportedly intervened in the FIFA World Cup to pressure FIFA President Gianni Infantino regarding a red card for U.S. striker Folarin Balogun, pronounced Fo-L-A-H-rin Bilo-H-Gun. By reportedly using Article 27 to bypass disciplinary codes, the White House secured a favorable outcome. UEFA has publicly criticized the move as a breach of protocol. This is a hell of a thing to do with a straight face. It turns a sporting event into a display of raw executive power. By treating FIFA as an extension of the administration, the U.S. has signaled that it prefers personal influence over merit. This compromises the legitimacy of the entire tournament. It invites retaliatory interference from other nations and makes the U.S. team's future success look like a product of political favors rather than athletic skill. We are seeing similar structural issues in the United Kingdom. Investigations into Nigel Farage have highlighted his reliance on private patronage from figures like George Cottrell, a convicted criminal and crypto entrepreneur. Farage calls it personal support. Investigators are calling it a conflict of interest. When a politician is lobbying for crypto interests while being bankrolled by a crypto entrepreneur, the lack of transparency is a direct hit to democratic integrity. These parties are struggling to balance their populist rhetoric with their dependence on these opaque, elite financial networks. When these networks are exposed, the political cost is structural. It forces the parties to distance themselves from their own foundations or risk being seen as vehicles for personal gain. The administration's broader approach to governance, which some are calling the Trumpification of federal resources, is causing friction at the local level. In Surprise, Arizona, residents are considering dissolving their own municipal government just to block a federal prison camp. When citizens feel they have to destroy their local institutions to defend against federal overreach, the standard operation of the state has effectively broken down. Ultimately, we are seeing a collapse in the boundary between private interest and public duty. Whether it is the deregulation of over 30 firearms rules at once, or the repurposing of national anniversaries into vanity projects, the goal remains the same. The administration is prioritizing personal control over institutional stability. The left is not providing much of a counterweight either. Their failure to build a media infrastructure that can actually reach disaffected voters is a massive strategic liability. Right-wing media is operating as a closed-loop, high-production system that reinforces a reality for its audience. The left is still relying on fragmented, uncoordinated digital efforts and traditional print. They are losing the ability to shape the narrative or explain complex topics to people outside their own circle. If the left continues to view media as a cash register for fundraising rather than a primary tool for cultural influence, they are going to keep losing people. Patriotism is being contested in real time. One side views the country as a possession to be defended against internal enemies. The other views it as a promissory note that requires active collection. Those who assume democratic progress is inevitable are, frankly, not paying attention to how fast the ground is moving under them. That is the political landscape. Speaking of things being built on shaky ground, let's look at where the AI industry is actually putting its money. Microsoft has launched what it calls the Frontier Company, deploying 6,000 engineers to client sites. This is forward-deployed engineering, a strategy designed to bypass the gap between AI potential and actual employee adoption. Meanwhile, Meta is turning its massive internal data center investments into cloud infrastructure, setting up a direct challenge to incumbents like Amazon Web Services and Azure. This shift is creating some friction. Anthropic has launched Claude Science for drug discovery, which puts them in the position of being both a software provider and a direct competitor to their own pharmaceutical clients. That's a delicate spot to be in. Some businesses are already pushing back. Microsoft has reportedly banned internal use of some Anthropic models, citing concerns that their data retention policies override corporate compliance requirements. Regulatory pressure is also changing the plumbing of the internet. Cloudflare is now blocking AI training crawlers on ad-supported pages. This moves the goalposts for how the web is indexed, likely favoring big publishers with licensing deals while leaving smaller players in the cold. OpenAI is also reportedly exploring equity sharing models, including a possible 5% stake for the U.S. government, to align incentives and ease regulatory friction. It's a play for survival. Bake the public benefit into the company's structure to keep the regulators at bay. While the corporate giants fight over infrastructure, the labor market is quietly decoupling from traditional headcount. We are seeing a surge in what you might call the high-revenue solopreneur. Solo business applications in professional services, finance, and information have grown by nearly 27% since early 2024. This isn't just a trend. It's a shift in how value is built. Data from Stripe shows that the number of solopreneurs hitting million-dollar revenue milestones more than doubled between 2023 and 2025. Projections suggest that by 2026, solo founders could account for 63% of new C-Corp. AI is acting as a force multiplier here. It replaces the need for traditional teams to handle marketing, sales, and strategy. Research from Harvard and INSEAD suggests that AI-native startups are 25% smaller and flatter than traditional firms, despite having the same valuations. The message to the corporate world is pretty clear. If you don't adopt lean structures, you're going to get outpaced by someone working from a laptop. But there is a darker side to this build-out, and it looks a lot like the lead-up to the 2008 financial crisis. The U.S. AI industry is currently fueled by massive debt. While some reports claim high failure rates for corporate AI projects, the capital expenditure remains intense. Companies like Oracle and Microsoft are diverting nearly half of their revenue into AI infrastructure. They're betting that the market will scale fast enough to cover the debt, but that's a massive gamble. China is adding to the pressure by using low-cost, open-source models to erode the pricing power of American firms. They are essentially using market efficiency to undercut the U.S. sector. Meanwhile, financial institutions are packaging this risky AI debt and selling it to pension funds and insurance companies. If the sector falters, the government will likely be pressured to step in as an insurer of last resort to prevent a wider economic contagion. It's a high-stakes game of chicken. The industry is lobbying for regulations that create high barriers to entry, which protects the incumbents but also stifles the innovation needed to actually lower costs. It's a shitty situation for everyone involved, except maybe the people holding the debt. Finally, the software industry is moving away from open architectures toward proprietary, locked-in ecosystems. New development environments like Cursor mean that when a company builds its stack, it's not just buying tools, it's committing to a platform. This forces a choice between speed and long-term sovereignty. If you're building your entire business on a model that could be restricted by government intervention or vendor whim, you're not building a moat. You're building a cage. The smart money is moving toward model-agnostic tooling, which is the only way to avoid being at the mercy of these volatile infrastructure providers. So you are building a cage instead of a moat. It is a hell of a gamble, but at least it's not as boring as the current state of horse racing. The Saratoga meet is underway, and with it comes a familiar headache for the industry. Leaders want a 40-day calendar, but that long, stretched-out schedule is killing the competitive intensity and boring the fans to tears. It's a classic case of prioritizing tradition over the reality of how people actually consume a sport today. If you are looking at the horses, keep an eye on mechanical flaws. Take the 2-year-old colt booked. He's got an 85 speed figure, but he can't switch his leads to save his life. Most people see a bust, but smart trainers see a massive performance ceiling once they fix the mechanics. It's almost better to bet on a horse with a correctable flaw than one that's already peaked. Then you have the European shippers. The market consistently undervalues them in races like the Belmont Oaks, mostly because bettors can't get their heads around the different track configurations and shipping stress. Don't make the mistake of reading European form too literally. The price disparity between a talented international horse and the domestic favorite is where the real money is hiding. Also, watch for the cleanliness heuristic. If the track's infrastructure is falling apart, it's a safe bet the training operation behind the scenes is just as sloppy. It's a systemic signal that people love to ignore. Moving to the wider landscape, the Blood Horse Monday panel says the industry has a serious concentration problem. The Horse of the Year race is already narrowing down to a few names, with the 3-year-old colt Magnitude sitting at the top after his wins in the Stephen Foster and the Dubai World Cup. The problem is the feedback loop. Early season wins in the Triple Crown or other Grade 1 stakes carry so much weight that they create an artificial hierarchy. It forces trainers like Brad Cox to constantly gamble between protecting a horse's perfect record or throwing them into a meat grinder of a race just to stay relevant in the rankings. This brings us to the availability premium. Because the top of the leaderboard is so crowded, upcoming races like the Whitney and the Breeders' Cup Classic are essentially winner-take-all events. If a horse like Nitrogen manages to beat the top-ranked males in the Whitney, the narrative shift will be instant and total. The industry is moving away from just counting wins. It's becoming a game of defeating specific rivals to climb the ladder. If you're betting, look for horses that can handle different surfaces and keep showing up. In a season this volatile, being available is becoming more valuable than being perfect. Tradition is a hell of a drug, but it doesn't pay the bills like a packed stadium. That brings us to the money flooding into the World Cup. The 2026 World Cup is currently generating a massive economic surge for host cities. Transaction data from Square shows that bar and restaurant spending in Boston jumped 28% during group stage matches, with similar double-digit gains in Philadelphia and Seattle. This 8% national revenue increase is providing a needed lift during the traditional summer slump. But here is the catch. This entire economic model is tethered to the continued success of the U.S. men's national team. That reliance on the USMNT is creating some messy governance issues. As mentioned, FIFA's recent invocation of Article 27 to clear Follerin Balogun following political pressure has drawn public condemnation from UEFA. When disciplinary protocols start bending for political convenience, the perceived fairness of the whole tournament starts to evaporate. It is a shitty situation for host cities, too. FIFA keeps the lion's share of revenue from broadcast rights and sponsorships, while local governments are left holding the bag for security and infrastructure. It is essentially a subsidy for a private entity, and if cities don't start seeing a real piece of the profit, the political appetite for these mega events is going to dry up fast. Meanwhile, in the NBA, the Boston Celtics are signaling a major shift in how teams operate under the current collective bargaining agreement. By trading Jaylen Brown, the organization is prioritizing financial flexibility over keeping a high-usage star. The front office is clearly betting that avoiding the crushing tax penalties of multiple Supermax contracts is the only way to remain a contender long-term. It is a cold, calculated move that has left fans feeling pretty sour, but it is the new reality of the league. Teams are no longer building dynasties. They are managing assets in a constant state of flux. If you are looking at the NFL, the first 3 weeks of the season are currently being treated as a high-volatility laboratory for bettors. The strategy here is to exploit fast futures, wagering on performance over a three-week window rather than the whole season. It is all about finding volume based on schedule-dependent matchups and depth chart shifts due to injury. You are betting on coaching tendencies and specific defensive weaknesses, which allows for a clean exit before the broader market catches on. It is a smart way to play the variance, provided you aren't married to the idea of a player's reputation. The common thread here is that we are moving toward an era where short-term optimization is the only game in town. Whether it is FIFA bending rules for political optics or NBA teams dumping stars to save on tax bills, the days of prioritizing long-term stability or ironclad regulatory consistency are effectively over. It is a high-stakes, volatile environment where those who don't pivot fast enough are going to get left behind. FIFA knows how to chase a dollar, even if it means bending the rules until they snap. That same hunger for a breakthrough is driving the book market right now. Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan have published a book, Asterisk Regime Change Asterisk, which argues that the executive branch is now a black box. They contend that verified, granular reporting on the administration now requires the kind of institutional infrastructure that only outlets like the New York Times can provide. Here is the thing about this new reporting model. It creates a massive barrier to entry that is effectively a systemic bottleneck. The authors claim that this kind of work requires significant legal, technological, and editorial support to survive the leak hunts and the pressure, which honestly leaves independent or smaller outlets standing on the outside looking in. The authors make a point about why books actually matter in a world of endless digital noise. They argue that daily journalism is fundamentally ill-equipped to capture the scope of a presidency. By pulling back from the daily cycle, they can build a narrative with clear boundaries. It lets the public see the cumulative impact of policy decisions, which would otherwise just disappear into the daily churn. It is a solid point. We spend so much time reacting to the tweet of the hour that we lose the thread of how the government is actually functioning. But there is a darker side to how this gets done. The authors describe the process as a form of professional obsession. They say the work required to bypass the administration's secrecy and verify accounts inside a closed, loyalist circle is not sustainable. They have gone on record saying they would not do it again. They see the intensity of the work as a physical and mental threshold that cannot be hit twice. It leaves us with a pretty shitty situation for the future of journalism. The market is clearly done with speculative commentary and rehashed hot takes. People want a factual anchor, but the only way to provide that anchor is to turn reporting into a high-stakes, high-burnout endeavor that requires institutional backing and a borderline deranged work ethic. If the barrier to entry keeps rising, we are looking at a future where the ability to document the presidency is concentrated in very few hands. That means the public is vulnerable to whatever singular, well-resourced narrative manages to break through the secrecy. Anyway, that is the state of the industry right now. We are trading long-term health for accountability, and the gatekeepers are getting fewer and further between. The gatekeepers are definitely shrinking, which is a problem when everyone is trying to optimize their brain for a world that feels like it's spinning off its axis. Let's talk about that. Jim Quick argues that human potential isn't fixed, but rather a result of how we manage our brain's hardware and software. He suggests that meta-learning, or learning how to learn, is the most critical skill today. Quick warns that using AI to handle all our critical thinking risks cognitive atrophy. Instead, he suggests using it to customize information or quiz ourselves to maintain our mental muscles. He also emphasizes that big changes don't come from one massive fix, but from the compounding effect of small, non-negotiable habits. Meanwhile, a separate approach to productivity suggests that big goals are achieved through subtraction, not addition. The core argument here is that we often fail to reach targets because we are spread thin by secondary tasks. These tasks create noise that buries our main mission. The advice is to stop taking on roles just because we are capable of doing them. Instead, we should ruthlessly eliminate anything that doesn't align with our primary objective. Finally, research in environmental neuroscience suggests that nature is a functional requirement for cognitive performance, not just a nice place to take a walk. Modern life relies on directed attention, which is a finite resource that wears out. Studies show that people perform about 20% better on cognitive tasks after spending time in nature. This happens because natural environments contain fractal patterns that are easier for the brain to process than the chaotic, dense stimuli of urban life. Look, it's a lot of advice to digest, but if you're feeling fried, maybe stop scrolling for a bit and go look at a tree. It's not just a pleasant thought, it's literally science. The rest of this, the meta-learning, the strategic quitting, that's just the hard work of deciding what actually matters. Most of us are just busy being busy, which is a hell of a way to live. A few other things worth knowing today. Alex Hormozi is back at it, arguing that business success isn't about the latest marketing hack. He says you have to keep your lifetime gross profit way higher than your customer acquisition cost, or the whole thing is just a slow-motion car crash. If you are heading for a divorce, NPR suggests treating it like a corporate restructuring instead of a scorched-earth battle. It turns out that keeping the family unit functional is actually possible if you stop trying to weaponize the legal system against your ex. The rental market is finally cooling down because builders finished 600,000 new units this year. There are so many empty apartments that landlords are actually having to offer real incentives instead of just jacking up the rent every 12 months. Finally, the Secretary of Defense is clearing out senior military leadership to purge what they call woke elements. It is a hell of a way to run a defense strategy, especially when you consider that creating a 20-year leadership vacuum is a fantastic way to compromise national security. That is the state of things for July 7th. We will be back tomorrow to sort through whatever else falls apart. See you then.